genuine. You can learn in mistake 8 how to ensure that it's not just you who is giving, but you also need to stay alert to the times when there is actually very little substance to what the other side is promising. We are all seduced by the talk of opportunity, partnership and relationships because it's what we want to hear. It sits more easily with most of us than having to be tough, direct and uninterested in the person we are negotiating with. But this can be dangerous. There are a lot of people out there who know that if you believe in the possibility of a beneficial partnership or collaboration, you will go easier on them, providing preferential terms or improved pricing. So they churn out convincing fake partnership talk, even though they never intend to repay the favour, place the repeat orders, or work in partnership. So how do you protect yourself? How do you know which type of negotiation you are really in? The five-factor test. The five-factor test can be used to gain an indication of the type of negotiation you are in. You're looking not just for the presence or absence of these factors – trust, dependency, complexity, relationship and risk – but the extent to which each factor exists in your negotiation. As a rule of thumb, all of these factors exist at low levels in haggling, but will gradually increase as you move through hard bargaining, trading and working together negotiations. Imagine that you are on holiday and you start to negotiate with a stallholder over the price of a leather belt. In that negotiation, there is no real demonstrable level of trust between the parties. Why would there be? The level of dependency is low, as you can easily buy a similar item from another stall nearby, and there is no formal agreement of any kind, nor any need to use each other in the future. The complexity level is low, as the only real issue you are negotiating over is price. There is no relationship of substance between the two parties. The level of risk if you overpay for the item or can't reach a deal is minimal. This is a haggling negotiation. But if we now jump over to a negotiation discussing a 10-year joint venture between two companies, the five factors look very different. A solid level of trust has to exist between the parties in order for the venture to succeed. Each party is dependent on the other for this to work. Plus, you are likely locked into a pretty complex legal agreement, which means you can't just up and leave. And how many other parties could deliver exactly what you need for this deal right now? Dropping your counterparty is likely to have severe implications. In a deal like this, there are likely to be multiple issues. In fact, possibly hundreds. These could include issues such as contract length, governance arrangements, office location, logo, price, staffing, quality control. As a result, the complexity level is going to be high. The ongoing relationship is probably going to be so key that there will probably be dedicated relationship managers on each side of the deal. The risk associated with this deal failing? Potentially huge, both financially and in terms of reputation. This is a working together negotiation. Undertaking a quick assessment of the five factors can start to give you some real insight into the reality of the negotiation you are in, but of course, it is just an indication. If you had assumed you were in a very collaborative negotiation, but upon examining it you realise that the other side have been wanting to only talk about price, low complexity, and are giving no firm commitments to future business, low dependency, then maybe you need to rethink how you need to approach it. We call this identifying your outliers. Outliers are the areas in a negotiation that seem to not quite tally with the other factors you have identified. If you identify outliers, you should consider how to address these issues when planning for the negotiation. Outliers. You may find yourself in a situation where the negotiation appears to be a classic hard-bargaining, competitive situation. Imagine that you are looking to buy a product as a one-off. You have identified a supplier locally. The only issue that will be up for negotiation is the price. You will have no need to work with the supplier again, and you have no existing relationship to preserve. However, in this situation, the consequences of you not securing the product in the next 24 hours are grave. It is imperative that you get this product. In this case, the risk and dependency factors are high. These outliers will require you to think about how best to contain and manage the potential issue. Would you be willing to reconsider price in order to ensure a timely delivery? Or would it prompt you to take additional steps to identify an alternative supplier if this one cannot guarantee the delivery speed you need? So as you can see, it is essential that you know your negotiation before you get anywhere near the negotiation table. Make sure you have understood whether you are planning for a value claim or a value create negotiation, and use this information to help you plan your tactics, strategies, and behaviours. Mistake 6. Never changing or adapting your style of negotiation. This mistake is very much linked to the previous one, and concerns the reluctance of some people to flex or adapt their style when at the negotiating table. As we have seen from the previous section, there is no such thing as a standard negotiation. Each one is different, and as a result, requires a difference in your approach. Many of us will have our preferred negotiation style. Around the world, I have met a great many good cops, a great many bad cops, lots of relationship builders, and plenty of ball breakers. It's certainly not a bad thing to know your strengths and to play to them if you can. The issue is if you are unable to ever deviate from your preferred behavioural style, regardless of the negotiation, using it in situations that would benefit from a difference in approach. How does this look in practice? In the previous section, we talked about the different types of negotiation that you might be expected to undertake at different points in your life or career. It might well be the case that you are more regularly exposed to more short-term, direct, competitive negotiations. As a result, over time, you may have developed your tough guy style particularly well. Because you know that your tough guy style seems to get you what you need, you use it every time you negotiate. But imagine what would happen if you rolled up to one of the preliminary conversations regarding setting up a joint venture agreement, being tough, direct, and uncompromising. The relationship and trust between the two potential partners in the room would no doubt be soured and could negatively impact the negotiations. Alternatively, it could be that your industry tends to be involved in more long-term collaborative relationships with customers or suppliers. As a result, you may have honed your empathetic style in such a way that it always seems to deliver the results that you need. You may come unstuck if you start talking about partnership, growth, collaboration, and opportunity to a stallholder selling bags or trinkets in a foreign bazaar. If you did that, they would be rubbing their hands in glee at the prospect of all the money they were going to make out of you. Of course, these are exaggerated examples, but the fact remains that the ability to move between behavioural styles is going to be incredibly useful throughout your negotiating career. Take a step back from your work environment for a moment. In our broader lives, we know that sometimes we are going to have to be tough, direct, and decisive, and other times we are going to have to be more thoughtful, collaborative, and understanding. We seem to understand and implement this concept in life generally, but for some reason a great many people report feeling uncomfortable about doing it professionally. In Chapter 11, I explore why this is perceived to be a particular problem for female negotiators. The main reason for this tends to be a fear of lacking credibility or authenticity if you were to regularly change your style. You may be concerned with being seen as disingenuous or worry that people will see through your act. People seem to have the most issues with playing it tough. The thing is, most of us will always retain an element of discomfort and awkwardness at having to stand firm, reject people, and play hardball. This type of style or behaviour is often the furthest removed from how we like to live our lives and how we would like our everyday interactions with others to be. But sometimes life calls on us to stand up and say no, to be louder, more forceful, stronger, or more assertive. That doesn't mean we have to change who we are forever, but we might have to modify the behaviours we adopt for a limited time in order to get the result that we need. The trick is to do it as credibly and professionally as you can, and in such a way that your nerves and discomfort don't limit you or trip you up. Use protection. When I was studying at bar school, I was given a wonderful insight by one of my advocacy tutors. A retired judge, he was a quiet, calm, and charming man who was incredibly approachable and interested in the progression of others. Yet he had enjoyed an almost fearsome reputation while on the bench for his no-nonsense style and directness. I remember one day asking for his advice. I had been struggling with some of the exercises that required us to be forceful, assertive, and at times, I had felt, almost overbearing to those we were questioning. I asked him how he had been able to flick into court mode so regularly and so utterly convincingly. He said that the trick was to use protection. He went on to explain that when entering the courtroom, he knew he needed to project a certain style in order to be respected and taken seriously, and yet he also knew that this style was quite different from the person he was at home and in his personal life. So, in order to allow himself to play the role of a tough, no-nonsense judge, he would see his robes as his protection. His belief was that in putting on his robes, he was putting on a suit of armour that would protect the person he really was inside, while also allowing him to project whatever he needed to in order to get the job done. After he was finished playing the role of tough judge, the robes would come off, and he could go back to being the quiet and unassuming person who just wanted to see his grandkids and get home in time for tea. We discussed how this same approach was also often adopted by people in the uniformed services, such as police officers or security guards. Of course, not all of us have physical robes or a uniform that we can put on before a negotiation, but we can all borrow the principle of using protection. Next time you go into a negotiation, think about what you could use to help you project the behaviours you need to temporarily, while preserving and protecting the real you underneath. Some people might carry a certain briefcase or wear a pair of shoes that give some confidence, but it doesn't have to be an actual physical item. It could just be that you put the item on mentally. Some people will refer to putting on their jacket, some to putting on a certain hat. Whatever works for you, use it. Alternatively, if you really struggle with this, why not take someone along with you who can play the role credibly and assign them to the task? A good example of this would be a married couple in which one spouse loves to haggle, but the other finds it cringeworthy. So, when shopping for furniture or a new car, they can each play a role. One might have a list of questions and requirements lined up, but when it comes to the nitty-gritty of price, their partner will take over. Or in a business setting, you might make sure that your negotiation team has a member who is more than happy to say no. If this is a strategy you would prefer to adopt, just don't fall into the trap of being an overly obvious good cop, bad cop comedy act. Mistake 7. Trying to get too comfortable. As we have already mentioned, negotiation can be uncomfortable. Not for everyone and not all of the time, but a large number of people will go to great lengths to avoid negotiation because of how it makes them feel. Because so many people think of discomfort as a negative thing that they want to stamp out, they imagine that the optimum place to be as a negotiator is one where you are relaxed and stress-free. Stop! This is a dangerous approach. We need to recognise that negotiation is inherently uncomfortable, and that actually, by embracing the discomfort and learning to live with it, you will be a far more effective deal-maker. In short, negotiation isn't and shouldn't be a walk in the park. The negotiators I train who most concern me are the ones who claim they have been there, done that, and have negotiated so many times that there is no need to worry too much about it. As a result, they take less time to plan and prepare and end up going into every negotiation limiting the possible outcomes they might be able to achieve. Negotiation is a very active and engaged skill. You need to be fully aware of everything that is going on around you. You need to be reading your counterparty, listening to what they are saying and how they are saying it, and watching them for clues, messages, and hidden opportunities. You need to be mindful of what you are saying and doing, and what messages you are giving to those you are negotiating with. It's important to be alert in negotiation so that you can be flexible and adaptable. Police raids. I spent a number of years working alongside officers in London's Metropolitan Police early in my career, and had the pleasure of working with some really experienced and interesting officers who had amazing stories and insight to share about human nature and the extremities of people's behaviour. I recall speaking to an inspector who was responsible at the time for dealing with an escalating drug problem on a housing estate. As part of the Met's campaign to address the problem, They were conducting a large number of raids on houses known to be dealing drugs and allowing drug use on their premises. This inspector told me that when they were planning a raid, they didn't worry about the more junior, inexperienced officers who were nervous and asked lots of questions. Instead, they were concerned about the experienced old-timers who felt they had done this kind of thing so many times that they didn't have to worry about it. His view was that the new recruits would listen carefully to instructions, think carefully about what they had learned in training, and remain focused throughout, making them a sharp, observant, and reactive support on a challenging operation. Nerves can work in your favour. They can keep you sharp, alert, focused, and receptive. Of course, that's only if they don't completely take over and limit your ability to perform. You need to get the balance right. Parts 3 and 4 of this book will equip you with the knowledge and insight you need to find that balance. Put simply, we need to accept that negotiation can be uncomfortable. All the advice in the world won't change that from being the case. But this knowledge can help you to manage that discomfort. Or, put another way, negotiators should follow the mantra of the US Navy SEALs and get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Mistake 8. Giving things away for free. When we negotiate, we tend to get fixated on achieving one or two things that are of great importance to us. Those things might change from negotiation to negotiation, and they could be factors such as price, deadlines, volume, or contract lengths. Understanding what matters to us is an important part of effective planning and of defining in advance what success at the negotiation table would look like. However, the danger is that when we become so fixated on achieving that one super important thing, we keep giving lots of other seemingly unimportant things away. The consequences of this strategy, incentivizing or seeking to desperately persuade your counterparty on a particular point, can be that you end up walking away with far less value or even in a weaker position than you were in the first place. Beware freebies. My team were contacted to provide fee negotiation training to a global professional services firm. When we were conducting our pre-training research with the firm, we were given insight into why they might be experiencing profit margin erosion. We discovered that 18 months prior to our appointment, the divisional director at the firm had informed all fee earners that there was going to be a new target hourly rate for certain pieces of advisory work. The target rate was set at £400 per hour. The staff were told that if they didn't consistently secure this figure, it would have a knock-on effect on their performance and pay reviews. As a result, the fee earners had this figure seared into their brains. It was all they thought about, all they could see. As a consequence, when they went to visit clients to try to win work, they would make the proposal of £400 an hour and then, in order to secure that amount, they would throw in all sorts of incentives and freebies such as training, project management software, additional partner time, junior staff on secondment and speedier completion. At the end of the negotiation, they would get their £400 an hour fee, but the cost of everything else they had given away meant that the overall value associated with the deal was hugely diminished, and their profit margin had shrunk as a result. So how did we help the professional services firm to resolve the problem? And how can you avoid falling into the same trap? Once we got them to understand that their current approach was leaking value, we simply introduced them to the following phrase. If you do this for me, then I can do this for you. If you, then I. If you, then I is probably the most powerful phrase in negotiation and has been advocated as an approach by a number of experts in this field. It can help you to ensure profitability, sustainability, and overall value. By phrasing all of your proposals this way, you help to preserve the value of the things you have to offer. You stop undermining your position and you see an increase in your bottom line. You can start to unlock and use the value in all of the possible trading variables. This is because when you ensure that you are only making concessions conditionally, that is, you are getting something from them in return, you are not just giving and giving and leaving your larder bare. By getting something back that you value, you are able to replenish your position. It works on another level too. It conditions your counterparty to see that you are more than happy to help them achieve what they need, but that they are going to have to work for it. They are going to have to offer you the things you want in order for them to access the things they want. Decide now to stop giving and giving and giving. Instead, start to trade. Take and give. In this section, we have looked at how, in a negotiation, it can be useful to make it clear that you are willing to help the other party get what they need, but that you need to get what you need too. To me, this goes back to pretty basic social conditioning around the value of working in order to get a reward, which is why I prefer the flipped expression of take and give, rather than the more commonly used give and take. I was recently trying to teach my toddler, Leo, that he would only get his favourite sweets if he was a good boy and kept his playroom tidy, as he had recently become adept at emptying hundreds of tiny pieces of Lego all over the floor and then refusing to clean them up. As part of this process, I explained to Leo that if he tidied up his bedroom, then I would give him a chocolate. I do it that way round, so he understands that he has to do the task before accessing the reward. If I had tried to do it the other way round and presented the chocolate first, he would have grabbed it and run before I could even mention that there was also a requirement to tidy his room. Mistake 9. Thinking it's all about you. This mistake is very much linked to the previous one. The problem is that we tend to think things are all about us, and I hate to break it to you that in relation to negotiation, they certainly shouldn't be. When we start to think about negotiating, we also start to think about everything that really matters to us, our issues, our priorities, our fears, and our successes. We become fixated on them, and they act like blinkers beyond which we can't ever really see. This is a problem because it means we miss opportunities that may exist in the negotiation, but that just happen to fall outside of what we have deemed important from our perspective. In a 2008 study, leading negotiation academics Galinsky and Maddox talked about the idea of getting inside your counterpart's head at the negotiation table. The study showed that seeing things from the perspective of your counterparty is one of the most powerful ways to influence the outcome of your negotiation. Why is this the case? It's essentially because you aren't the only one at the negotiation table who has pressures, stresses, strains, deadlines, and priorities. Your counterparty does too. And all of those things that might matter to them could present you with some real opportunities. But if you are too stuck inside your own head, thinking only about the issues and priorities that matter to you, you may not even see or anticipate that they have something going on which you could use as a lever to change the course of the negotiation. People negotiate with people. You need to get inside their heads to see the world through their eyes. How do things look to them? What do they hope to achieve? What does failure look like to them? Why are they here? What motivates them? The more we know about their fears, successes, priorities, and ambition, the more we can use that to our advantage. I don't just mean in relation to work either. I also mean in relation to their personal life. View your counterparty not just as an employee of their company, but as a whole person. For example, what if promotion is a real key driver for the person you are negotiating with? What if you have been able to establish that if they could get the deal with you here today, their chances of promotion might be increased? If you know this, you might be able to use it. Similarly, if you know that your counterparty is a new parent, then you might be able to build rapport by sharing stories of sleepless nights, and this could influence how the rest of the negotiation then unfolds. The advice here is not to get too bogged down in what matters to you. Of course, it's important to be clear in your own mind about what success and failure looks like to you, and what all the different elements of the deal are to you. The trick is to make sure you know it for them as well. The second real danger associated with not getting inside their head is that not only might you miss an opportunity, but you might also really anger them. You see, a mistake that many people will make at the negotiation table is to assume that their priorities are matched by their counterparty's priorities. They approach the negotiation thinking that everyone around the table wants the same things or values them to the same degree. The reality, however, is that different people value and interpret things differently. Your priorities might not be their priorities. Why is this an issue? Because people don't like to feel that you haven't taken them seriously, listened to them, or considered their point of view. One of the things that my team sees on our workshops is people approaching negotiations assuming that each side wants the same thing, or that everyone prioritises the same issue. Just because you prioritise securing a certain level of fee and a defined delivery date doesn't mean that the other party will also prioritise these things. They might be more concerned with quality assurance or credit terms. Don't assume. You have to take the time to really uncover what matters to them. By doing this, you can start to frame your proposals in such a way that it becomes clear that you have at least started to understand their issues, and, as a result, they will feel far more valued and listened to. Of course, there will always be variables in which both parties have an interest. This is inevitable, and these are often the areas that are the most difficult to negotiate an agreement on, as you are likely to have conflicting views. As a good example, price will often be a key driver for each side in assessing their success in a negotiation. Often, the buyer will want to pay the lowest price possible, and the seller will want to secure the highest price possible. In these situations where each side will be approaching a key issue with very different aims, you can use your understanding of all of the other issues that they might prioritise to try to craft a deal that not only works for you, but works for them too. For instance, as the seller, you might be able to convince the buyer to pay a higher price if you incentivise them with another of their priorities, such as deferred payment. Developing and using a knowledge of their priorities can be an effective way to smooth over any potential areas of conflict. There is a third danger in not fully understanding your counterparty, which is that you may be giving them the emotional upper hand. Have you ever been in a negotiation with someone who is really intimidating? Someone who is incredibly assertive, outspoken, confident, and completely unflappable? Nothing you do or say seems to sway them at all. You begin to dread having to engage with them. They make you question your own ability. They are your negotiation nemesis. Getting inside their head is the first step to bringing the balance of power back over to you. Because that confident, intimidating, unflappable person is only human too. If you could get inside their head, you would see that they also have pressures, priorities, a boss, deadlines, fears, ambitions, a conditional bonus, a mortgage to pay, family and aspirations. All of those things will be whirling around inside their head during a negotiation. The more you know about what those things are, the stronger your position will be and the stronger you will start to feel. In part 3, we'll come back to the psychology of negotiation, working on negotiating with different people and how to bring back the balance of power with different counterparties. Mistake 10. Uncertainty on making the first move. Whenever I or my team run a negotiation workshop, regardless of where it is in the world or the industry in which we are running it, we will always ask delegates the same question. Who should make the first move? Interestingly, this is often one of the most controversial issues in the workshop. It causes more questioning and pushback than anything else we teach on our sessions. So, who should go first? In 8 out of 10 cases, the answer we get back from people in the room is the other side. This response is pretty standard, regardless of experience, seniority, geography, industry, or culture. I have also watched hundreds of negotiation role plays and case studies and seen many examples in which people desperately try to avoid making their offer first. They will often say something like this, "You go first." "No, I asked you. You tell me." "I'll tell you once you've told me." "Well, I'd rather not say." "No, give me your number first." These are all classic examples of the kind of avoidance tactics we see once it gets to the stage when someone has to make the first move. There has certainly been misguided wisdom spread around that you should always try to get the other side to go first. In fact, a great many sales skills workshops advocate this method. However, making the first offer in negotiation is one of the best understood and most compelling tactics to help you end up with a deal that is preferable to you. The volume and quality of research on this point is huge, and I would challenge you to find any robust evidence or research that points to the contrary. The very simple reason why going first in a negotiation can be so powerful is because of something called anchoring. Anchoring is the cognitive bias that sees even the smartest of people being too heavily influenced by the information that is put first on the table. This might be in relation to the price of a product or service, the terms of a contract, or a salary increase. By making the first move in a negotiation, you are essentially anchoring the other party to your starting point, because right there and then, it is the focus of everyone's attention. This can then lead the other party to shift their expectations about what they can get from the deal, and lead to you walking away with a more favourable outcome. The research findings on making the first move in a negotiation and the power of anchoring are numerous. Headline findings include: if you go first, you are far more likely to walk away with the preferential result. Anchoring still impacts your counterparty even when they are an expert and should know better. It happens even when we are warned that it might impact our response. Put simply, you should make the first move, as that way you have more of a chance to grab and maintain the advantage. Yet we continuously look to the other party to get the ball rolling and go first. Why does this cause us such problems? Why are we so unwilling to put our offer on the table and make the first move? More often than not, it comes down to uncertainty, lack of confidence, and insufficient preparation. Here are a couple of common reasons I hear for not wanting to make the first move, and tips to help you move past them. 1. But I want to know what they are willing to give me. Negotiation is not about waiting to hear what they are prepared to give and then responding. It is about developing and presenting proposals and packages in such a way that you get them to agree to what you want. By waiting for them to set the boundaries as to what the agreement is going to look like, you are walking into the trap of agreeing to a deal that is designed from their perspective. It's going to work in their favour, not yours. Do not wait to hear what they are willing to give you. Instead, do your research, see the next point, and let them know what you might be willing to give them. 2. What if I go first and I get my opening figure totally wrong? People are often concerned that their opening position might be so inappropriate that they end up agreeing a deal far below what they could have got, or annoying the other party so much that they end up deadlocking or coming to blows. If you have effectively explored the product, service, or market in question, researched your counterparty and their situation, and are clear on your own value, worth, and position, then you should be able to craft an opening proposal that is both ambitious and realistic. Take a look at mistake 11 for more on this point. So what happens if you don't get to go first? Of course, there are always going to be situations where you can't go first. Maybe in your industry there are regulations and norms which require that one side makes the first proposal, or maybe you just don't get in there quickly enough. Make sure you don't fall into the following traps. Don't keep going on about it. A common trap that people fall into is to keep going on and on about the proposal which has just been made to them. They respond with incredulity or disbelief and begin to critically analyse the detail of what has been suggested. It's not uncommon for people to just keep repeating back the proposal they have just heard, almost as if they were mimicking their counterparty. How much? £4,000? Really? £4,000 is ridiculous for this. Seriously, if you think £4,000 is a price I can accept, then you are sorely mistaken. £4,000? Come on! After all your shock, disbelief, and rejection of their £4,000 proposal, what have you achieved? Nothing. You've not gone anywhere. You've not moved from the £4,000. Instead, you are still right there, anchored to that £4,000. I view that initial £4,000 proposal as a deflated balloon. At the point when it's put out onto the negotiation table, it is pretty empty. It's very much present and is the only thing we all have to look at, but it could be made bigger by blowing into it. Which is exactly what you do every time you talk about that £4,000 balloon, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Don't ask them to explain themselves. The next thing people will do is ask their counterparty to explain the proposal they just made. You might think that this is a sensible thing to do. that by asking them to explain themselves, they will somehow see the error of their ways, fall over their own point of view, and end up undermining themselves. This very rarely happens. In most situations, by the time people get to the negotiation table, they have already invested a lot of time, energy, and enthusiasm buying into their own position. Of course they will be able to explain themselves, and probably very eloquently too. All the while they are blowing into that £4,000 balloon. We also need to think about the purpose of asking for their explanation. If you have just been presented with a proposal that you could never agree to or accept, why bother asking them to explain themselves? All you have done is waste valuable time listening to an explanation that makes absolutely no difference as to whether or not you can agree, and you have reinforced and strengthened their anchor. So, if you know you can't agree to it, don't waste valuable time asking them to explain it to you. There are far better ways of getting what you want. Don't be swayed by it. One of the worst things you can do if the other party goes first is to allow it to cloud your judgment. Imagine that your counterparty is the buyer, and they go first and offer you far less than you had anticipated they would for your product or service. The danger is that you then reposition your request to look more reasonable or in line with the one they have just made. This can be the case even when you have done your research and are confident on your opening position. Dragged down by an anchor. Imagine that you are looking to sell your shirt, and I am looking to buy it from you. You might be thinking to yourself that you are going to ask for £20, and that you would be happy to settle for slightly less than that. However, before you can open your mouth to say anything, I jump in and say, "I like that shirt. I am prepared to offer you £6 for it." The mistake people often make is that they then deviate from their plan. When I make my very low proposal to you, the little voice in your head might start to say to you, £6? That's way lower than I thought she would offer. Maybe I was being a bit overambitious with £20. Maybe I should ask for less, or else I might look a bit greedy. Then, when you do open your mouth to make your proposal, you say, "Sorry, I can't agree to £6. I was looking for £14. Immediately, by moving from £20 to £14 to more closely match my proposal of £6, you have limited what you might have achieved. I might have been willing to go far, far higher than £6, but now you have ensured that I will never go higher than £14 and have vastly increased the likelihood of finishing closer to a figure that works better for me than for you. Cast out a new anchor. So, what should you do in response to the other party going first? The best way to deal with it is to recognise that by dwelling on their proposal, you are making it stronger. Instead, thank them for their proposal and then offer up your own. This way you begin to anchor what you want from your perspective. "Thanks for your proposal. However, my proposal to you is in fact..." The more you get them to talk about and focus on that, the more likely you are to get it. Talk about your numbers, your position, and your request. Anchoring is real. Researchers have observed that many people struggle with the notion of anchoring and going first because it suggests a lack of free will on our part. If this is you, get over it. Anchoring is real, and it matters to all of us. So try to go first if you can. But if you can't, for whatever reason, don't be naive or unaware as to the impact that their opening proposal could have on you and your performance in the subsequent negotiation. Be aware. Don't fall into the trap of reinforcing or giving way to their anchor. The exception to the rule? I would actively encourage the other party to go first if I had just been presented at the last minute with a negotiation that I knew nothing about and had no immediate way of finding anything out about before I was due to meet them. Then, along with observations about their body language, style, and the words they used, I would use their first proposal as the start of my evidence to help me understand their thinking and a possible strategy. Mistake 11. Not opening ambitiously enough. One of the areas that prompts some of the strongest reactions whenever we mention it anywhere in the world is also one of the most commonly practiced tactics in negotiation. I am referring to opening ambitiously. The idea that the more you ask for, the more you get. I also like to refer to this as testing the water, or leaving yourself plenty of wriggle room to explore possibilities. In the housing market, it is not uncommon for a seller to place their house on the market at one level, even though they know that they will accept a slightly lower level. The first level is the seller's ambitious opener. At the same time, a buyer will initially offer a far lower amount than they know they can reach to. This is the buyer's ambitious opener. The breakpoint here is the absolute maximum the buyer can go to and minimum the seller can go to. We'll discuss breakpoints in more detail later. The concept of asking for more than you need or offering less than you can afford really troubles some people. They find it uncomfortable, misleading, and disingenuous. I will often have pushback from people saying, "This doesn't happen in my industry," or, "My clients and I are honest with each other. We don't play this game." "Really?" I ask. "And how do you know that?" "I just do," they say. "How?" I ask. "How do you know they are not inflating their prices ever so slightly to get that bit more out of the deal?" That's where it tends to go quiet. You don't always know whether the other party has opened ambitiously or not, because they are highly unlikely to tell you in advance that this is what they are doing. "Hi, just before we begin, I wanted to let you know up front that I'm going to start at £600, but I can really drop down to £520. Just letting you know in advance. Keep pushing me and I'll get to the real price eventually." The reality is that most people will try to explore what the best deal is that they can get, and some will do it subtly with opening proposals that aren't outlandish or ridiculous. Think of these examples. The seller, who initially says they cannot under any circumstances accept less than £450 for their product, but who ends up settling for £375. The buyer, who says they absolutely have to have the project completed in 3 weeks, but they end up agreeing to 4. The solicitor, who starts by demanding £10,000 on behalf of their client and ends up settling for £7,800. The newly engaged couple who insist to their family that they are absolutely only having a small wedding, who end up with masses of guests who they haven't seen in years. In all of these circumstances, the negotiator has tried to improve the chances of what they end up with by opening ambitiously. The logic is that by opening far higher or far lower than what you actually need or expect, you leave yourself room to manoeuvre, are able to explore just what the other side's boundaries might be, can make them feel like they have won, and can end up influencing your counterparty in such a way that they reassess what they might have been willing to agree to, either consciously or subconsciously. Why does opening ambitiously work? Why does this work? We're back to anchoring again. The science of anchoring isn't just about who goes first, it's also about what we choose to put out there, to what level, and the impact which that has on the end result of the negotiation. There is a stack of writing out there on opening ambitiously, but one of the most compelling examples is a piece of research conducted by Chapman and Bornstein on awards made by juries. The more you ask for, the more you get. In 1996, psychologists Gretchen Chapman and Brian Bornstein presented 80 students with identical hypothetical medical negligence cases. The students were broken up into 4 groups of 20, and each of the 4 groups was presented with a different demand for damages from the claimant's legal team. The average award given by each jury member in each group is as follows. Demand, $100. Average award, $990. Demand, $20,000. Average award, $36,000. Demand, $5 million. Average award, $440,000. Demand, $1 billion. Average award, $490,000. It seems that the jurors were incredibly persuadable and guided by the anchoring effect of the differing demands made by the claimant's legal team, as factually, there were no other differences in the cases presented to the 4 groups. What is also interesting is that the seemingly outlandish claim of $1 billion still resulted in a higher average award than any of the others. The evidence shows that the more ambitious you are and the more you ask for, the more you are likely to get. Whether we like it or not, we are influenced by the size of a number that is presented to us early on in an interaction, be that an informal conversation or a more formal commercial negotiation. When someone presents us with their number, or anchor, our brains cannot help but to think about that number. The challenge, of course, is to move away from their number as quickly as you can and start to think about an alternative that works better for you. Amos Tversky, one of the researchers behind the famous United Nations experiment on anchoring, in which participants were asked to estimate how many African countries were part of the United Nations after spinning a wheel of fortune, had a theory that anchoring is so powerful because when we are presented with the other side's anchor, we then mentally adjust it upward or downward. We will continue adjusting until we reach a zone of plausibility, and then we stop. Tversky believed that the issue we have with moving away from ambitious openers or anchors from our counterparty is that we stop too soon. Instead of moving away from their anchor to the furthest possible point that would represent the best deal for us, we stop too readily at the first plausible, comfortable answer. Their anchor can therefore curtail our belief or ambition as to what could be achieved, and so we then make a counteroffer nothing like the one we had originally planned, and are instead heavily influenced by what they have just requested of us or anchored us to. Opening ambitiously creates wriggle room. We previously discussed the impact of an ambitious first move on our perception of what the possible boundaries of the deal might be. But understanding the effect on you only works if you then go on to move. One of my mantras is that negotiation is all about movement. The point being that if each side refuses to move, then you actually have a standoff, not a negotiation. This is particularly true when it comes to opening ambitiously. If you open ambitiously but then refuse to move from that potentially extreme point, you are cancelling out the benefit that movement can bring. Opening ambitiously can have the bizarre effect of making your counterparty feel like they are winning. Let's imagine you and I are negotiating. The company I work for sells a service that you would like to buy. Because I understand the benefits of opening ambitiously and anchoring, I make the first offer of £17,500 for my company's services, even though I know I could go as low as £15,000, my breakpoint. You had been anticipating spending far less than this, and respond with, OK, that's a lot more than we had budgeted for. I was thinking closer to £14,500. At this point, the balance of power sits firmly with me, as I am then able to make use of my wriggle room, having started at £17,500. I respond with, OK, I can't go that low, but if you can pay us in 20 days rather than 30, then I can drop to £16,220. And right then, at that moment, you have won. You have managed to secure a drop on the price from me. I have moved towards you, and therefore, psychologically, you have scored a victory. Of course, so have I, as not only have I secured £1,220 more than my breakpoint, I have also secured more preferential standard payment terms. I have immediately cast myself as the person who is willing to be creative and flexible when it comes to trying to reach a deal, and you are happy because you have moved me from my opening proposal. A 2002 study supports this assertion. Researchers discovered that negotiators were much more dissatisfied when a first offer was accepted than they were with achieving the same outcome after multiple rounds of negotiating. The thing is, you can only move in the way I have in this example if you open ambitiously in the first place. Let's instead imagine that I believe opening ambitiously is in some way disingenuous or unethical. So I decide that transparency is the best option to progress the relationship and get a deal done. This time I make a commitment to share my actual breakpoint of £15,000. This is how I open. Great to see you. Look, I don't want to waste your time, so I can tell you straight away that my best price is going to be £15,000. I hope you appreciate that I'm being honest with you on this, as I really value our relationship. OK, I'm really going to need something closer to £14,500, you reply. Can you make any move on that? Sorry, no can do. £15,000 really is the best I can manage. I really was being honest that I can't do better on price. So you're saying that you are not prepared to move at all? Is there nothing you can do? I really can't shift on that price. I'm trying to do the right thing here. Really? It feels to me like you're just digging your heels in. This doesn't feel much like a partnership to me. At this point, I have two options. I can choose to stay where I am, sticking at my honest and transparent opening proposal with a frustrated counterparty, or I can move. The problem is that because I didn't open ambitiously and went straight in with my breakpoint, if I do move closer to £14,500, then I start to lose in terms of the overall value of the deal. My profit margin risks being eroded, dangerous precedents are set, and neither side feels satisfied with the deal because the whole interaction has felt like a battle. When is ambitious too ambitious? While opening ambitiously is essential, it is always worth being mindful of the point at which you have opened too ambitiously, the point at which the proposal lacks any form of credibility and becomes ridiculous. We call this the get real point. It's the point at which your counterparty might well tell you to get real, and you run the risk of damaging both your credibility and the deal. So, how ambitious is too ambitious? There is no magic formula. The barrier really depends on a number of different factors, and can change from negotiation to negotiation. It might be impacted by a previous relationship, the people present in the room, past conversations, the industry in which you operate, precedents, legislation, etc. Consideration of all these factors and what might constitute the walk-away barrier should be a key part of your negotiation planning. However, experience has taught me that the worry is seldom whether you have been too ambitious. It's more frequently the case that people are not ambitious enough. You'll know instantly if they accept your ambitious opener straight away with no questions asked that you have completely misjudged the issues and boundaries in this deal. If they accept your opening offer happily, you haven't been ambitious enough. I always advise my clients to work out their ambitious opener and then add on another 10% just to counter the tendency most of us have to misjudge what we really mean by ambitious. Because of the power of anchoring, the next time you get to the negotiation table, you need to go first if you can, but know how to deal with it if you don't. When you do make a proposal, open ambitiously, but credibly. Mistake 12. Arguing rather than negotiating. You will never win an argument in a negotiation. Ever. A lot of people confuse the act of arguing with the act of negotiating. They think that being an amazing negotiator is all about their ability to effectively contradict or undermine the position of their counterparty. There is no denying that the ability to formulate your point of view in a persuasive way will help you in the wider negotiation process, but that's not what we're looking at here. We're talking about a full-on, heated argument or relentless bickering over the details, something I see happening way too frequently with negotiators of all levels of experience. The mistaken assumption is that arguing will bring you some kind of benefit. However, often it merely wastes time and limits the potential outcome at the negotiation table. Imagine that you are sitting down to negotiate. Your counterparty makes a proposal of £12,500 for your product. You are visibly unhappy with this and respond argumentatively by saying, "How much? Really? Are you joking? That is an absolutely ridiculous proposal, which leads me to believe that you can't have done your research properly. Did you just pluck that figure out of thin air? My product is worth much more than that." How likely is it that your counterparty will respond like this? "You know what? You're right. That is a ridiculous proposal.